Good afternoon, everyone, and thank you for joining us for March's Small Animal Practice Club webinar. I'm very pleased to introduce our speaker for today, European and RCVS recognised specialist in small animal surgery, Daniela Mergia. Thank you, Daniela. I'm now going to hand over to you.
Good afternoon, everybody. Thanks for joining us in this webinar on laryngeal paralysis. We start with a short introduction about laryngeal paralysis, which is a well-recognized and potentially life-threatening condition seen predominantly in older large breed dogs. However, it is also increasingly being recognized in cats. The condition results either from the dysfunction of the caudal laryngeal nerves, which are terminations of the recurrent laryngeal nerves, or from the damage of the dorsal cricoarytenoid muscle. The caudal laryngeal nerves control the contraction of the cricoarytenoideus dorsalis muscles and subsequently the adduction of the arytenoid cartilages during inspiration. The dysfunction of these nerves or muscles, and therefore secondary muscle atrophy, results in failure of the arytenoid abduction and medial displacement of the vocal folds during inspiration, leading to upper airway obstruction. The laryngeal paralysis can be unilateral or can be bilateral, can be a congenital condition or can be an acquired condition. Most studies in literature report that male dogs are more commonly affected than female dogs. We start having a look at the congenital laryngeal paralysis, which is an hereditary form of disease in young dogs, mainly reported in bull terriers, Bouvier de France, Siberian Huskies and Siberian Huskies crossbreeds, Dalmatians, Rottweilers, and white-coated German Shepherd dogs, Leonberger and Pyrenean Mountain dogs. The congenital laryngeal paralysis in Bouvier de France, for example, is a condition secondary to Wallerian degeneration of the recurrent laryngeal nerve, whilst in Siberian Huskies or Husky crossbreeds and white-coated German Shepherd dogs, the condition is thought to be associated with the white color of the coat and the blue eyes. A laryngeal paralysis polyneuropathy complex, which is also named LPPNC, is mainly due to neurogenic atrophy of the intrinsic laryngeal and appendicular skeletal muscle, and this has been described mainly in young Dalmatians, Rottweilers, and Pyrenean Mountain dogs. And then more recently, it has been described X-linked recessively inherited polyneuropathy and laryngeal paralysis in young and adult Leonberger dogs. The congenital laryngeal paralysis, in most of the cases, the clinical signs in most of the cases are noticed at young age, usually before the year, and include increasing loss of exercise tolerance and respiratory dysfunction, reflected by the progressive upper airway stridor. They have dysphonia, dyspnea, and they can collapse. Furthermore, they also show signs such as regurgitation, vomiting, and progressive inhalation pneumonia, aspiration pneumonia. This is related to the fact that these dogs can present also megaesophagus, and it has been seen in young Rottweilers that some of them can present hiatal hernia. These young dogs also show, as we will see in the next videos, some degree of ataxia or paresis, and in some cases also head and muscle tremors. The prognosis for dogs with this kind of laryngeal paralysis appears to be poor, even with palliative treatment. The surgical correction of the laryngeal paralysis in these animals should be considered with caution because the polyneuropathy may continue to progress, and usually these dogs die within the first couple of years of age. The congenital form of laryngeal paralysis can occur also in cats. So now we have this first video. This is Toby, a young husky. As you see, he's white, 8 months old, and this is how he was clinically with his panting respiratory pattern. Toby also showed neurological signs, which are very subtle and are reported in the next videos that we are seeing. So you need to have a look at the gait of the dog, and in particular at how the hocks are, the angle of the hocks. So bright-based stance and extended hocks, which is indicative of some dysfunction of the peripheral nerves. Toby underwent a laryngeal procedure, laryngeal lateralization procedure, and we took a biopsy. And I have reported here for you the results of the biopsy. I hope you can see it, but basically if you look at the conclusions here, so I said and for histopathology, the cricoarytenoideus dorsalis muscle, and the results was that the pattern of muscle, there was a pattern of muscle fiber atrophy, and all the histopathological findings were indicative of congenital laryngeal paralysis polyneuropathy. And this dog unfortunately died a few months after the surgery due to aspiration pneumonia. The acquired laryngeal paralysis is the second form, probably the most frequent one, is very common in Labrador Retriever and Golden Retriever, which you see here on the top of the image, but it has also been described in Great Danes, Irish Setters, Afghan Hounds, and Saint Bernards. The acquired laryngeal paralysis can be secondary to multiple factors, like, for example, not very frequently, but it can happen. Can be secondary to a high iatrogenic injury of the recurrent laryngeal nerve during surgery, such as, for example, thyroidectomy, or can be secondary to injury because of trauma, infection, and again, neuromuscular disease. However, in older dogs, the acquired form of laryngeal paralysis is most often considered idiopathic. And acquired laryngeal paralysis may also occur as part of a paraneoplastic syndrome or be associated with endocrine or metabolic disorders such as hypothyroidism or diabetes mellitus. As a paraneoplastic syndrome, explains the fact that in these dogs we usually tend to do some sort of staging to check up that there are no masses, intra-abdominal or intrathoracic masses, before any kind of surgery. In dogs with hypothyroidism, for example, even if we do supplement the thyroid hormones, usually the laryngeal paralysis does not resolve, is permanent. There has been described cases with myasthenia gravis, which have developed laryngeal paralysis. In cats, who undergo bilateral thyroidectomy could be at risk for damage of the recurrent laryngeal nerve. But as I said, the most frequent form in elderly dog is the idiopathic form. Recent evidence strongly suggests that dogs with idiopathic laryngeal paralysis might have an underlying chronic progressive generalized polyneuropathy or neuromuscular disorders, and the paralysis of the larynx may be only one manifestation of a more complex condition. In support of this theory, it has been reported neurogenic atrophy in laryngeal and pelvic muscles and nerve axonal degeneration in laryngeal and peroneal nerves in dogs affected with this disease. This is why, in these cases, electrophysiological tests like the electromyography are very helpful and can support the suspect of peripheral nerve abnormalities. The clinical signs of a neuromuscular disease include generalized or focal muscle weakness, normal to depressed spinal reflex, very slow withdrawing reflex, for example, and muscle atrophy. It is very interesting that usually the neurological signs are not observed immediately upon diagnosis of laryngeal paralysis. They might develop in the long term, maybe after a year, after 2 years. Again, the clinical signs are very similar to the ones seen in the congenital form. The median age of onset is around 9 years. They are early in the disease. The owners might notice changes in the voice or inspiratory stridor or an exercise intolerance. Sometimes owners do think that the dog is reluctant to move just because he's old. They also may have dysphagia regurgitation, which predispose these dogs to aspiration pneumonia. This is because there is, together with the changes of the recurrent laryngeal nerves, there are often changes, degeneration of the pararecurrent laryngeal nerve, which is the nerve that one of the nerve that supplies the cranial esophageal sphincter, and therefore with these the pararecurrent laryngeal nerves not working, we have problems with the swallowing, and this dog developed dysphagia. Usually, dogs with unilateral laryngeal paralysis, very rare, monolateral or unilateral laryngeal paralysis, but in case it was unilateral, usually the dog is asymptomatic. So the clinical signs are evident in dogs with bilateral laryngeal paralysis. Exercise, obesity, and excitement, and also a very hot environment, so increased environmental temperature generally, can rapidly exacerbate the signs. These dogs may develop an inspiratory dyspnea that is not alleviated with open mouth breathing, and because the primary means of heat loss in dogs is evaporation while panting, a dog with an upper airway obstruction, like brachiocephalic, for example, might be more susceptible to hyperthermia due to the lack of heat dissipation through heat dissipation. Therefore, the rectal temperature, the body temperature, should be always keep monitored and checked, and also signs for possible heat stroke should be kept monitored. This is from a paper from Compendium. Now it's a bit old, but this is the frequency, the percentage of cases showing stridor, exercise intolerance. So you see that most they are not very many will collapse, but I have seen dogs collapsing because of the laryngeal paralysis. Talking about cats, the congenital form or acquired form of laryngeal paralysis has been sporadically reported in cats. There is no breed predisposition or sex predisposition, and the median age of the acquired form is around 11 years. Clinical symptoms again include tachypnea, dyspnea, inspiratory stridor, weight loss, cough, anorexia, because maybe sometimes there is a concurrent disease, lethargy, cyanosis, and fever. Regurgitation is not very frequently reported in cats. And also, as in dogs, laryngeal paralysis in cats may occur in conjunction with a polyneuropathy. In cats, the clinical signs can be evident also with monolateral or unilateral paralysis, and the left side is the side that is mostly affected. This because the recurrent laryngeal nerve on the left side seems to be more, is longer and seems to be more susceptible to damage compared to the right side. So now we are going to have a look at a series of cases just to show you for, the classical presentation of laryngeal paralysis. So the first one is Nancy. She was a Jack Russell Terrier, female spayed, 8 years old, and she was attacked by a dog at the level of the neck, and she was presented like that as emergency. I don't know if you can hear. I cannot hear very well the stridor of the dog. I hope you can hear it better than I can. So, Nancy, we will see further ahead with the presentation. We will see these patients again after the laryngeal procedure. Millie is a Labrador, female spayed, and 12 years old. And actually, she was presented in a routine appointment. And during the consult, you can see she was really, really struggling with the breathing. So you can see in this video how the effort, that the abdominal breathing that she has to, the abdominal muscles she needs to use to breathe properly. So this dog should have been seen probably earlier and not as a routine appointment. Tilly, another Labrador. You will see many Labradors in these videos. Labrador, female spayed, 9 years old. Look how she's struggling. The long tongue, extraflexed, she can barely walk, so very tired dog. And then we have Alpha. Alpha is a husky, is a 13 years old, so this is an acquired form, is not a congenital. Again, a very you can hear the stridor. So he barely moves. And Maisie, sorry, Maisie, this was another Labrador. She was like 11 years old. And again, the stridors and the panting, open mouth breathing. The next one, surprise, surprise, is another Labrador. It's Scooby. May Newton, 9 years old. So the stridor can be a bit different in different dogs. So now the clinical suspicion is an important tool in diagnosing laryngeal paralysis. And if an affected animal is stable, it should undergo a thorough physical examination and a thorough diagnostic workup, which include also the thorax, assessment of the thorax and the cardiovascular system, because we need to rule out any evidence of pneumonia, aspiration pneumonia, or pulmonary edema, or abnormalities that could contribute to exercise intolerance. I would certainly recommend to do a neurological assessment in these dogs, just to see if there are any signs related to a peripheral polyneuropathy. A complete blood count and serum biochemistry profile are usually within normality in these dogs, unless a concurrent disease is present. However, we may find hypercholesterolemia and hyperlipidemia, and increased liver enzymes, which might be suggestive of an ongoing hypothyroidism. And therefore, I would recommend to send the bloods also for a thyroid function, so in particular endogenous thyroid stimulation hormone, TSH, and free thyroxine. Certainly abdominal and thoracic radiographs, as well as abdominal ultrasonography, should also be routinely performed, and this belongs to staging, just to rule out that there are masses, intrathoracic or intra-abdominal masses, which might justify or explain the laryngeal paralysis as paraneoplastic syndrome. And also the thoracic radiographs permit to look for concurrent aspiration pneumonia. So you see here in the end of the list, obviously the laryngoscopy is a clinical assessment that allows you to confirm the suspected laryngeal paralysis. And then you see here EMG, which means electromyography, and muscle and peripheral nerve biopsy. I tend to do an EMG in all the patients just to check if there are signs of peripheral neuropathy. Regarding the muscle and peripheral nerve biopsy, I tend to send to take a sample from the cricoaritenodeus dorsalis muscle during the lateralization procedure surgery, and send the muscle for histopathology. The labs need special staining, so not every lab can do examination of a muscle for a peripheral polyneuropathy. I don't do a biopsy. I don't perform a biopsy of the peripheral nerve usually. Sorry. The next slide shows you Molly. She's a Shih Tzu, 12 years old, with again a laryngeal paralysis. She was presented collapsed, struggling with the breathing, open mouth breathing. But what I want to show you here is the general clinical assessment and neurological assessment. So Molly was not able to stand up, was not able to walk. And what you see here is certainly, you see also the hock is plantigrade. And these are some of the signs that you can see. This is very severe, to be honest, very severe clinical presentation. Indicative of advanced peripheral polyneuropathy. Molly underwent further workup, including X-rays and abdominal ultrasound. You can see in these images is the abdominal ultrasound. Molly had a gastric mass, at which point the owner didn't want to proceed with any kind of surgery, given the prognosis. I cannot tell you which kind of tumor was this in the stomach wall, because the owner didn't want to proceed to FNA or biopsy. So once you have your suspect of a laryngeal paralysis, then you need to confirm it, and you confirm it with a laryngoscopy or assessment of the laryngeal movements. And to do that, you need to have the animal anesthetized. The anesthetic protocol is pretty important. We will see videos later on how the depth of the of the anesthetic plan might influence your diagnosis. In any case, this is what we tend to use. So we want a dot that is fairly superficial in the anesthesia. So we should be able to open the mouth, but we should still see the laryngeal reflex. And sometimes they might also bite you. Be careful. So before inducing, we do pre-oxygenate for 3 to 5 minutes. And then we can give butorphanol at the dosage that you can see in this slide. And we can induce with propofol. We do induce with propofol over a minute to effect. You can also use other protocols. I have written here diazepam, for example, and ketamine. But there are other protocols described in literature. This is what we usually use and is a protocol we are happy with. So this is our MAISI. Certainly, this patient need an intravenous catheter placed before the examination, and again, be pre-oxygenated with flow-by or oxygen mask.
So, like last time, do you remember? Yeah.
So this is the moment before induction.
We got 2 times.
And I just want to make you aware of what could happen in dogs that do not cope very well with the laryngeal paralysis. So this was Millie, the one that was presented in a routine appointment where I said that she should have come as an emergency. So basically, we had the plan to do the full diagnostic workup, and when we sedated her to assess the larynx, she could not cope anymore with the condition, and she nearly collapsed, so that we had to anesthetize, and I decided to proceed directly to go to theater before doing any other, because the owner wanted treatment. So she didn't have any concurrent disease, and she had the laryngeal lateralization, and then she was fine. So before looking at videos on how the larynx moves to help you to recognize a laryngeal paralysis, I would like to mention or describe a little bit of anatomy, because it's very difficult if we do not know perfectly the anatomy of the larynx. It's also very difficult to make a diagnosis when the larynx is in movement, because everything goes very fast. So basically, you need to look at the larynx. You see here is the epiglottis. So the epiglottis needs to be pushed down with a laryngoscope. And then you forget it. You just need to focus on the rima epiglottidis, which I'm showing you here. The vocal folds, there are two, one per side. And then you need to look at the corniculi process of the arytenoid cartilage, which is this and this. And then you have the cuneiform process of the arytenoid cartilage, but you don't need to look at that. So you just try to forget it. You just focus on the corniculi processes of the arytenoid cartilage and on the vocal folds. These are the two structures you need to focus and you need to observe to make your diagnosis. In fact, laryngoscopy and observation of the movements of the arytenoid cartilages under light plane of anesthesia is the diagnostic method of choice for laryngeal paralysis. Patients with laryngeal paralysis fail to abduct their arytenoid cartilages, and the vocal folds are medially displaced during inspiration. This is important because it's a pathognomonic sign. So in the next few slides, we will see the different anesthetic plane and how they can influence your diagnosis. For example, the video I'm going to show you is a video where the anesthetic plane is too deep. And if the anesthetic plane is too deep, every dog will appear to have a laryngeal paralysis, so, and you will make a wrong diagnosis. So therefore, the patient needs to be sufficiently lightly anesthetized to be able to open its mouth and for the larynx to be visualized. So let's see. This video is is coughing, we are saying in every time during inspiration. Oh, no, but you good. See, there is no movement.
If you can say in, so that I see
of the arytenoids, the vocal folds are medially displaced, but there is no movement. So this could be a paralysis, but you see, I'm staying with the laryngoscope on the epiglottis, there is no reaction, so this dog is too deep. So we need a lighter anesthetic plane, which I'm going to show you in the next video. So I think before I show you the video, I will describe you what is going to happen, because it will be difficult to see everything whilst I'm speaking. So whilst in a normal dog, the arytenoid cartilage is this, I'm sure you know in the video, this should abduct at each inspiration. And the vocal folds, which I'm showing here, these and these, should remain under light tension. This is in a normal dog. In dogs with laryngeal paralysis, the edges of the arytenoid cartilages, first of all, are swollen and inflamed, and you can see it already here, a bit of edema. And the vocal cords are descend. You see how they are displaced medially and in contact with each other. So, this is called a paradoxical motion of the vocal fold cords, which you will see, and this might confuse you in your diagnosis. Basically, during the paradoxical motion of the vocal cords, the cords are pulled into the rimaglottidis at inspiration and return to normal position during expiration. And it should be other way around. So during inspiration, the vocal cords should the vocal folds should stay away from the rimaglottis, should not be medially displaced. This is called paradoxical motion and is due to the so-called Venturi effect. He's a physician, which is an effect where when the air travels through a narrow tube, the velocity of the air increases, inducing a decreasing pressure, so a negative pressure, I would say, that can pull the two vocal folds together. So this is why it is important to time the motion of the arytenoid cartilages during inspiration, especially. It's important to say in during inspiration so that you know what in which respiratory phase is the dog, and in the meantime you're looking at the larynx and you're looking at the vocal folds, and you can in this way identify the if there is a paradoxical motion and therefore paralysis of the larynx, or if the dog is normal. Let's have a look at the video now. So you need to, again, you will see a bit of movement here probably, but the most of the movement is of the vocal folds. When the vocal folds are pulled medially because of the Venturi effect, paradoxical movement, then also they pull together the larynx, and then you have the wrong impression that this larynx is working, and in reality it's paralyzed. Okay, let's go for it.
Very well. Very well done.
So I hope that after what I said, and maybe I can show you the video again.
Very well.
So you see here the vocal folds. Sorry if I'm boring, I think this is a very important aspect of the laryngeal paralysis. And we have another video with an adequate anesthetic plane. Another Labrador. I think this was Millie in the end. And she's a bit far away, but again you see the vocal for displaced medially. A bit of movement, but this is because the vocal folds just pulled the arytenoid medially. Once you have done this, we do EMG. I understand in the everyday general practice it's not always easy to do an EMG, and we do an EMG just because we want to give a prognosis to the owner, just to give a complete picture to the owner about the case. And we do add the EMG, the electromyography test, together with the neurological assessment. And the abnormalities that usually we look for are here reported. Basically, we look for a fibrillation potential and positive sharp waves, and then we check the nerve conduction velocity. In particular, we do it at level of the peripheral nerve, so the limbs, and we also test the larynx, the laryngeal muscles. I have here a video with an example where you can see the so-called fibrillation potential in sharp, positive sharp waves, which basically mean when we stick needle in a muscle, if the muscle is normally and healthy and the innervation is healthy, maintained, usually we have like an effect, we call it like a frying oil, but when there is a denervation, then there are like abnormal electrical activity of the muscles. It's very easy to explain, so I'm not a neurologist, so apologies for that. And then you see spikes and electric activity, like in this case. So this is an information to add to our examination. So these peripheral nerves or these nerves innervating these muscles are degenerated. So once we have done that, obviously we have done abdominal ultrasound, we have done chest x-rays, we want to decide which kind of treatment we want to do. So we have a medical versus surgical treatment. This patient can be presented, as I was mentioning before, with acute upper airways obstructions, cyanosis and collapse, which usually recovers if we do treat them medically in a correct way. So we need to look at all these points. So the excitement or the increase in the environmental temperature can trigger an acute onset of inspiratory dyspnea. When the body temperature increases, they try to pant to dissipate the heat, and then this results in a trauma to the mucosa of the retinoid cartilages with inflammation and swelling, which again in circle can exacerbate the chronic airways obstructions and make the inspiratory dyspnea even worse. This starts then a vicious cycle. So first, the animal should be taken from the owner if it's in an emergency, and should be placed in a cool environment with supplemental oxygen. You can use a fan, a big fan, full power. You can ice water bath. You can shower the dog so with cool water, or you can use ice packs. You need to lower the temperature down. You can sedate, certainly. You can use acepromazine at the dosage that I have reported in these slides. But be careful, because acepromazine can be hypotensive, so they need to be on fluids with an IV, so maybe even two IVs. We use also medetomidine. You certainly can give corticosteroids, so either prednisolone or dexamethasone, depending on what you have. So I would go for dexamethasone. We don't have prednisolone IV here, so we go with dexamethasone colvazone IV once or twice, and then we put them on fluids. But again, be careful with the fluids, because animals with severe upper respiratory tract obstruction can develop pulmonary edema. So you need to tailor this the rate of fluids to the patient. If the patient's condition is deteriorating, then we don't have much choice. So either we do the surgery, if we can do the surgery, so the laryngeal lateralization, or we need to perform a temporary tracheostomy to stabilize the dog and be able to send it to a referral center if you cannot do it yourself. Here I've reported all possible surgical approaches. There are many with different outcomes. What I would go for, so I have pretty much experience in the laryngeal lateralization, so this is the surgery I do prefer, and I think the outcome with this technique is very good. What do we do with the laryngeal lateralization? First of all, the procedure is usually very successful, so we are around a 90% of success, a good outcome. The lateralization is unilateral, it's never bilateral, because if we do it bilaterally, we increase exponentially the risk of aspiration pneumonia. So we can do, you see here, either a thyroarytenoid lateralization or a cricoarytenoid lateralization. These are two surgical techniques which are different just in the way we place the suture. The arytenoid cartilage is always involved, but in the thyroarytenoid, the suture is placed between the arytenoid and the cricoid, and in the cricoarytenoid lateralization, the suture is placed between the cricoid cartilage and the arytenoid cartilages. Which is the difference of the two techniques is that if we do a thyroarytenoid, so suture between arytenoid and thyroid, the arytenoid cartilage is displaced laterally only. Whilst if we do a cricoarytenoid lateralization, the arytenoid is displaced laterally and caudally. There is also some sort of rotation. So in terms of anatomy and changes that we are creating, the cricoarytenoid lateralization seems to be the best technique. But they are both equally effective in terms of outcome. When we do surgery, we do position our patient in lateral recumbency. So people, right-handed surgeons do usually perform a left-sided laryngeal lateralization. And left-handed surgeons usually do right-sided laryngeal lateralization because it's technically easier. And these are a couple of images showing, again, the technique. The trick here is to know, again, very well the anatomy of the region, because there are nerves, there are blood vessels. And this is how the surgery, pre and post surgery, here is pre-surgery, and this is how it should look after surgery, and this is in a dog pre and post-surgery. I'm thinking what I want to say about this. We need to be careful when we do the lateralization. This is very important. We don't need to pull too much the suture to tie the arytenoid back, because we just need to open the rima glottidis a little bit more than it is in the paralysis, because if we open it too much, the epiglottis will not be able to close completely the rima glottidis, and this dog might be again predisposed to aspiration pneumonia. So now let's go back and see our patients that we have seen at the beginning. So we remember Nancy. Nancy was bitten at her neck, and this is how she arrived. And the video below is one day after surgery, after left-sided laryngeal lateralization. So you can all see how rewarding is this kind of surgery, how good is the outcome. Then we have Millie. Millie is the Labrador that was collapsing, the one that had a routine appointment and was collapsing during pre-oxygenation. And this is this is pre-op, and this is post-op. Okay, very nice. Sorry. Then we have Tilly, the dog that was in the waiting in the consulting room on the floor, struggling with the breathing. Again, pre-op.
No,
ma,
there is a huge difference between yesterday and today.
And my comments, ignore my comment because this. I was very excited about the results.
Okay, let's see yesterday.
And then we have Alpha. Alpha pre-op, very, very, is struggling a lot, and this is post-op. Also very nice. And Scooby. Pre-op. And the video below, the second video is Scooby after 2 months, actually. Yona was very, very happy. So as you can see, again, the outcome is, most of the time, I would say 90% and 95% the outcome is good, at least in the short term until they develop further conditions. I would recommend this kind of surgery because the quality of life is completely different after surgery. But there are obviously some complications that can happen during and after the surgical procedure and also in the long term. So the intrasurgical complications, you have them listed here. The intrasurgical complications include hemorrhage, peritoneal cartilage fragmentations, and failure to achieve adequate opening of the rimaglottidis. The hemorrhage usually, if of course, very rarely, but if of course, it can occur from dissection and mainly from transection of the cricoitenoid muscle or the thyropharyngeal muscle, and also when we open the cricoitenoid joint capsule. So therefore, meticulous hemostasis throughout the procedure is important and recommended, because an hematoma, if an hematoma develops, then we might have issues with the holding of the suture, and also we can have acute airway obstruction. The over-manipulation of the arytenoid cartilage and the use of cutting needles for passing the suture could lead to fracture of the cartilage, and this leads to impossibility to conclude the procedure, which means we need to close the incision and turn the dog on the other side and to do it on the other side, which would mean for me that I'm a right-handed and I'm doing the surgical procedure on the left side, means to close the dog and turn the dog and do the surgical procedure on the right side, which would make my life more complicated and also the outcome might be compromised. Then we have the post-operative complications, which include over-abduction of the rimaglottidis, again hematomas or edema of the glottis, and aspiration pneumonia. These complications, the first two are normally evident within 24 hours. Avoiding over-abduction and minimal dissection of the muscles during surgery obviously can reduce the incidence of this kind of complication. Depending on the degree of the over-abduction, patients can cope with a complication, or we might need to do a revision surgery. And again, we need to respect all the surgical principles, so good hemostasis and management of the dead spaces, because again, these poor hemostasis or dead space may lead to laryngeal hematoma or edema, which might require a temporary tracheostomy to bypass the obstruction. Then we have the long-term complications, which include, in particular, the arytenoid suture pull-through. So the arytenoid cartilage doesn't break, doesn't fracture, but the suture cut the arytenoid cartilage through, and then the suture doesn't hold the lateralization in place. And in brachycephalics in particular, because this procedure can be done also in brachycephalics with laryngeal collapse, we might, because of the weakness of the cartilaginous scaffold of the larynx in brachycephalics, we might land to have a contralateral arytenoid collapse if we do laryngeal lateralization. We have major complication after bilateral arytenoid lateralization, which are aspiration pneumonia, and therefore we should really avoid to do bilateral laryngeal TBAC to reduce the incidence of the pneumonia. In case I've never done in 15 years, I've never done a bilateral lateralization, so actually I wouldn't consider it at all. In cats, complications after laryngeal lateralization are around 54%, and include aspiration pneumonia, postoperative dyspnea requiring temporary tracheostomy, and in some cases Horner syndromes and laryngeal stenosis. So let's have a look at a failure. This was Maisie. Maisie had a laryngeal paralysis. She had, strangely, the surgeon that did the surgery was a right-handed surgeon, and I'm not sure why the surgery was done on the right side. And you see that clinically the dog doesn't show any kind of improvement. So this dog had a revision surgery on the left side, but also the left side failed, and then we landed in doing a permanent tracheostomy. So she had the tracheostomy, so you have here the images, and then you have the videos of Maisie before the tracheostomy with, again, the failed laryngeal lateralization, still struggling, and then after with the tracheostomy, permanent tracheostomy, and you see how she can cope. Every now and then she coughs, but this is normal. How she's coping very well. And Maisie lived another year and a half
Maybe.
after this procedure, and died for condition something that was not related to the laryngeal paralysis. And again, I've mentioned the aspiration pneumonia. This is Oliver, and he developed aspiration pneumonia. You see in these radiographs. After a couple of days after when he was discharged, and he came back with very depressed fever and with these radiographs. And obviously, at this point, we need to handle the aspiration pneumonia, so certainly providing oxygen. And depending on the severity of the case, we might need either we do a trial with antibiotics, so broad spectrum, coupage, nebulization, or we do a bronchoalveolar lavage to send it for culture to pick up the correct antibiotics. I would go with the first option in first instance, so broad spectrum antibiotic and fluids, coupage, oxygen, and see how the dog does. And if there is no improvement, then I would consider the BAL. And then we want to have a look at how to manage this patient postoperatively. These dogs should not be offered water and food until fully awake from the general anesthesia, obviously. They should to not also not be heavily medicated with analgesics and sedatives during recovery, unless they are super stressed, so that the swallowing reflex is maintained. And very important, hand feeding. So I always feed my patients with laryngeal paralysis myself after surgery, because I need to see if they can swallow properly first, and secondary if during swallowing there is any signs of aspiration. So small meatballs, hand fed, not early than 24 hours after surgery, and I ask to offer water only after the animal can swallow the meatballs, and I ask to offer water every 2 hours. I don't want to have free access to water and food. And the owners receive the instructions to hand feed their dog. I've written here 2 weeks post-op. Actually, ideally for life, because from now on, these kind of patients will be always predisposed to aspiration pneumonia. So if the owner has time, is committed, hand feed of meatballs is the best way to protect the airways of these dogs, considering that most of them Labradors, and they are so greedy that they just aspirate the food in 1 second when they have the bowl available. And then rest for 4 to 6 weeks post-op, absolutely no swimming, and hardness is very important. And here I have the video where I show you how I feed them. So she's very hungry. So I just give one meatball and see that she chews, she swallows properly. I guess here at some point she will do like a cuff. She will cuff. I'm not sure if we have seen, but anyway, very slowly, we need to give the time to the dog to swallow. So, take home message. First of all, laryngeal paralysis is in most of the cases acquired, and in the acquired cases is idiopathic, and can be the first signs of a more complex disease, i.e. laryngeal paralysis, peripheral neuropathy complex, LPPNC. Certainly the medical management can be successful if the respiratory signs are mild. So not all dogs with laryngeal paralysis should undergo surgery, just the ones with very severe signs or in emergency situations. And the laryngeal surgery resolves most of the time the respiratory signs, but most of the time does not address the primary underlying cause. And I think this is my last time. I see that we are on time. I thank you for your attention, and I'm very happy to answer any question if you have. Thank you. So you see here, I have written down my email. So if you have questions in the future, in the next hours, following days, then just drop me an email and I will be happy to answer you. You can also call me at the AHD. So I'm here. I'm on clinics. So happy to help in case you need.
On behalf of Webinar Club, I'd like to thank Daniela for an excellent presentation today. The recording and the certificate for this webinar will be available in the next few days in the members' area of Webinar Club. Thank you all for attending. That's the end of the webinar.